Stay tuned for Occupied Territory America, hosted by Mike Fader.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
And this is Occupied Territory America, hosted by Mike Fader. That would be me. We've been here about, what is it now? I guess going on 2 years this fall. It'll be 2 years. Started right after the occupation. Occupation sprouted up all over the country. The one in New York, of course, and everywhere else. One on Wall Street. And the show has been evolving, but it is basically about what the show was originally set up for and what the Occupy movement was originally all about, which is income inequality. The fact that so few people in this country have so much money and most of the rest of us have practically none, or what we have that was once a livable amount of money doesn't really buy much anymore, and we're all in tremendous debt. So that's what it's – and, of course – you know, springing from that, the political system and everything else is completely captured by corporations and the rich. And so they own each branch of government, all of them together. And we don't really have much of a democracy anymore, as we can see from daily reports in the paper and the kinds of outrages that you see everywhere on television, you hear on the radio, you read in the paper. And this show is here to talk about those things, kind of ring the alarm bell, and then to try to invite people on here who might have positive solutions, either activist solutions, you know, what you can actually do about this mess. If there is anything to do about it, we will talk about it. People who are doing things, lawyers, activists, people in every part of life, and also a psychological approach to this, because in times like this, you tend to get outraged or despair. What happens is, this is typical for people, and you get very angry at something. But if you can't do anything about it, like you're in a situation which is unjust, personally, at your job, in the world itself, it's an unjust situation. It seems as if everywhere you turn these days, you are bombarded by unjust situations and inequity, injustice. And you get angry and you want to do something about it. And there have been cycles of rebellion and protest in this country where people have done things about this, and successfully sometimes, not successfully sometimes. I come from a generation that did get angry about a lot of things that were going on, wars, civil rights discrimination, things like that, and acted massively and nonviolently and generally. And things did change somewhat. But maybe it's not the same as it was then, or maybe some other way is needed. But one thing is always needed, and what is needed is a ray of light, something to say, you know, it's not always going to be this way. So there's two things involved here, I think, that this show is about and that everybody should be, you know, considering, is that it may look impossible, but that doesn't mean, even if it continually fails your efforts or it looks impossible, that you shouldn't keep trying. And that is, we have a guest on today who's written a remarkable, a wonderful essay about this whole idea, passionate, intelligent, inspirational essay about this. And, you know, like you, I get tired sometimes of bringing the news. I feel like I'm Paul Revere, you know, in Groundhog Day. I'm always, always saying, we're in a lot of trouble. We're in a lot of trouble. Okay, what do we do about it? Well, we just keep going on. And we try to figure out ways to approach this. One thing before we talk to our guest today is, you know, I keep telling you that this show is associated with, or we have a sort of a parallel ongoing show when the show is not on the air. And it's every Thursday at 2 p.m. for those of you who are new listeners. It's a Facebook page called Occupied Territory on Facebook. Occupied Territory Facebook. And you go there and I will post essays, occasionally a little sort of political sermon, things about culture and politics, mostly about politics, and people respond. You know, you can post your own videos, your comments on what I say. It's a kind of running debate and congregation of people who feel generally the way I suppose most of us feel. However, I wanted to ask you this. A lot of people aren't on Facebook. A lot of you listening to me now are not on Facebook, or a lot of people don't like Facebook, or they're dropping out. If you're one of those people and you want me to establish a blog, I have set up a political blog. I haven't started using it yet. It'll basically be whatever I post in occupied territory, and I do this about every day or every other day, I will also post on this blog. So if you're not a member of Facebook or you would rather do it on a blog, let me know. And this is what you should do. Go to my website, Federfiles, F-E-D-E-R, F-E-D-E-R-F-I-L-E-S.com. And let me know if that's what you would like, because I can phase out the Facebook page and go to the blog if it enables more of you to participate. Anyhow, enough of that for now. Let's see if we can get down to the bottom of some things here. We have a guest on the line, Robert Jensen. You there?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Where you are, it is now, what, 10 o'clock?
Just after 10 a.m. Central Time in Austin, Texas.
I'm always having trouble getting used to the idea that Texas, which seems so far from New York, is an hour earlier, but I will accept it. So Robert Jensen is a journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. Can you tell me what that is?
A group of left progressive folks concerned with global justice in Austin have been working for a number of years on anti-war activities, economic justice activities, and the Third Coast Activist Resource Center is a group we started to be the vehicle for that kind of work locally here in Austin.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it more later as we proceed. He has written a couple of books. His latest one is All My Bones Shake, Radical Politics in the Prophetic Voice. Radical Politics in the Prophetic Voice. And this is from Soft Skull Press, presumably available on Amazon and everywhere else.
Yeah, and there's actually a book since that one called Arguing for Our Lives from City Lights. So okay. same general attempt to make sense of a crazy world, but keeping it coming here.
Which is one of the essential points of your essay. Even though it continues to make no sense, you have to continue to make sense out of it, right?
Yeah, I think the world, of course, has always been complex and hard for us to understand, and in some ways is getting more complex by the moment. It's also, I think, clear that certain basic understandings about how power operates are pretty straightforward, and those are the building blocks, I think, for a reasonable analysis of how the world works these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me read the first paragraph, and then we can launch ourselves into the rest of the essay here. Feeling anxious about life in a broken-down society on a stressed-out planet, that's hardly surprising. Life as we know it is almost over. While the dominant culture encourages dysfunctional denial, pop a pill, go shopping, find your bliss, there's a more sensible approach. Accept the anxiety, embrace the deeper anguish, and get apocalyptic. And I know you're laughing, but, you know, because people automatically, when they as you explain in your essay, right, they automatically think of apocalypse as something that a fundamentalist Book of Revelations loony would be talking about, right?
Right. The term apocalyptic, which is from the Greek, and the corresponding Latin term revelation, both mean the same thing. They mean a lifting of the veil, a kind of coming into clarity. And so what I'm trying to do is reclaim that more basic meaning and get away from the kind of rapture talk that comes out of most of the contemporary interpretations of the Book of Revelation, the last book of the Christian Bible, and just the more general sense of a kind of world coming to an end. So I think a lot of people feel quite reasonably that the systems that make up this world can't go on forever, that we're kind of winding down in a certain way. I think that's a perfectly sensible reaction to the world. And the question is then how to make sense of it. What kind of analysis helps us? And, you know, people have different approaches to this. The more traditional apocalyptic notions of Christianity are not the only way to make sense of it, not the only way to use that term.
Well, people do have a sense, as you point out eloquently in your essay, that the world is coming to an end. And you say our world, as we know it, actually is coming to an end. I mean, and then that extends in all sorts of directions, right?
Right. First and most obviously is the ecological crises. We're looking at multiple cascading crises, not just global warming, although that's the most compelling, but on every measure of the health of this living world, the ecosphere, our ecosystems that make our own lives possible. On every measure, as I always say, the news is bad and getting worse. Groundwater contamination, topsoil loss, chemical toxicity, the health of the oceans, species extinction, dwindling biodiversity. There's not a lot of good news out there. And when we say that the sort of world is coming into an end, we don't mean the planet's going to blow up or that the entire planet is going to die overnight.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean is that a large-scale human presence, billions of human beings on the planet living something like the way we live today, is simply not sustainable. And sometimes when I'm joking with people, I say I've made a theoretical breakthrough that unsustainable systems can't be sustained. An unsustainable way of living can't go on forever. And there's a lot of denial about that in the culture. Some of it comes with the ideology of capitalism, this notion that there's somehow this magical formula for endless growth. Some of it's about, I think, a quite misplaced faith in the high technology that has been possible in the high energy era.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, those things are going to play out, and we're going to be left trying to make sense of a very different world. And I think there's a lot of people who actually feel that, sometimes just at a kind of visceral level, hence the anxiety that so many people feel.
Well, you know, what I always see is, and it seems very obvious to me, and this has been going on for decades now, but you see it more and more on this particular theme you're talking about, is sometimes popular culture, i.e. popular video games or movies, will reflect, like a canary in a coal mine, the distant early warning, unconscious signs of people apprehending that there sort of is an end of the world in a way. But, you know, they may see it the wrong way. But for the last 30 years, we've had the Terminator. There's 1,000 movies that have come out.
Sure.
And as you pointed in the book, so people do have the apprehension that the world may be coming to an end or is coming to an end. But as you point out, that technology and some brave hero using advanced technology will save us, right?
Yeah. I mean, the dystopic science fiction that you describe has been with us for a long time, and it's often extremely interesting and engaging. There is one book I always recommend in this realm that is not as widely known by an author, Octavia Butler, called The Parable of the Sower, which is a much more, if you'll grant this category, realistic science fiction. That is, It imagines this, but in a way that's much more likely to play out than, as you point out, you know, the magic flying machines that are going to save us or the single hero. But that anxiety that's expressed in those kinds of books and movies is very real, and we've had them with us, you know, the Mad Max kind of movie for a long time, and there's certainly more of them than ever. And as I say in this essay, which appeared in Yes Magazine.
Oh, I said I should have pointed that out.
Yeah, in their summer issue. You know, there's that anxiety, if it's left undiagnosed, sort of checked, usually makes us pretty crazy. And in the article, what I'm suggesting is that the way to deal with it is not to either deny it or to put on a happy face and say everything will work out, but to really try to get to the deeper emotion, which in that article I call anguish. Some people talk about feeling a deep sense of grief for the state of the natural world. But that's honest. And I think we actually make better decisions about politics and our social systems when we're dealing honestly. And so although it seems a little counterintuitive to say acknowledge the anxiety, embrace the anguish, get apocalyptic, I actually think that's the healthiest approach to dealing with all of these crises that we're facing right now.
I don't necessarily, for myself, I don't see it at all as counterintuitive. I see it as completely intuitive because it's related directly to, after all, what is not, when you get into, philosophical realms or scientific realms, but what in human activity is not related to what people feel internally in each person or in a small group, right? For instance, so you can feel anguish and despair in yourself and turn to all sorts of ways of of not and denial is possibly right. the largest one. Then there is, as you point out in here, there's an addiction spectrum. There's pills. Sure. There's movies. There's entertainment. There's sex. You can do anything. But unless people in their personal lives, and I've seen this myself too, if you embrace your own reactions to what was a natural disaster, let's say if you had a bad childhood, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you don't know it, I mean really know it and really sure. feel it, then there's no way you will ever grow out of the patterns you've developed to avoid behaving in an appropriate way in the world for yourself. If you expand that, and I think this works in most cases, you can see how it works in political systems.
Absolutely, and I think that that metaphor you use is very appropriate. Think about the best thing that has happened in the last decade for the health of the ecosphere, for the environment. Well, in a kind of odd way, the best thing that happened was the massive financial collapse and recession. Now, I'm not being glib about this, but mm-hmm. that did slow the consumption of resources. It slowed energy use, and that was good for the planet. Now, I'm not suggesting that the pain that people have felt and the suffering and the struggle is unimportant. Of course it is. But the economy, the formal economy, the political leaders, the corporate leaders, their response to that economic crisis was to say, let's go back to business as usual. Mm-hmm. Let's get going with more growth. And that will, in some short-term way, perhaps fix the economy. But the problem of the economy, the problem of mass consumption, corporate capitalism, can't be fixed that way, of course. We've got to have a long-term strategy for reducing our consumption, reducing energy use. This is hardly a new idea. People have been trying to sound this warning for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But now it's clear that if we do continue with business as usual, it's going to be game over, if not within my lifetime. I'm getting pretty old. I'm 55 almost, you know, but certainly within my kids' lifetime. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at, you know, a massive social dislocation. It's already happening in some places, the places that are most vulnerable both to the social and the ecological strain. So Christian Parenti, a very good journalist, wrote a book mm-hmm. a couple of years ago called The Tropic of Chaos, and he looked at that band around the equator.
Yeah, I read that book.
Good book. And what he's pointing out is that the combination of, you know, centuries of colonialism that undermined those societies and the stresses that are already present from global warming, he's not talking about some future, he's talking about today, is already having profound effects on people, resource competition, people moving into territories in search of water they never had to before, leading to conflicts. That is the future unless we start planning very quickly for a massive change.
I think people also, not to be too, you know, I don't know what to be. It doesn't. Why should I apologize for it?
Yeah, go for it, Mike.
A sort of a spiritual relationship to, before I was referring to a psychological, a parallel. But the spiritual parallel is that everything goes back and forth. And I'm a big reader of the I Ching and follower of Taoism, right? Mm. And, you know, as you point out, expansion cannot last forever. Contraction cannot last forever. Things change. Mm-hmm. But this idea of, and many liberals and liberal economists who I speak to frequently believe in this whole idea of, oh, growth. You know, if we haven't mm-hmm. grown, they analyze growth. And there's many essays written recently where people use the same metaphor, perhaps accidentally, or they imitate each other, that one of the things that grows constantly and never stops growing is cancer.
Right.
Right. You know, I mean, really, you know, growth cannot go on forever. There's got to be, in other words, people have to understand there's got to be a contraction. During World War II, for instance, and this refers to what you're talking about in terms of resources, just for instance, during World War II, there was gas shortages in this country mm-hmm. because it had to be rationed and used. Most of it was shipped overseas to use for the armed forces. There were these big signs posted on highways in the country that said, is this trip necessary?
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's time for us to all, this is skipping back and forth, but really we all have to wake up and see, is this trip necessary? Is this extra terrain vehicle necessary? Is this new TV? Is all of this necessary, right?
Right. You know, there's actually a good book that just came out by a great scientist and political thinker named Stan Cox. The book is called Any Way You Slice It, and the title's a bit vague, but what Stan's arguing is exactly your point, that rationing has been used in the past, that is, collective rationing through government, in times of obvious crisis, such as the World War II example. But Stan's arguing we're in that kind of crisis situation today, even though it's not dramatic and immediate in the same sense. And the only way to deal with that is through rationing. Now, clearly, we have rationing today. It's called rationing by price. If you have enough money, you can get lots of stuff. And if you don't have any money, you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a decent way to ration, you know, if you take basic moral principles seriously. And so Stan is arguing that we have to start building an argument for rationing. And I can't agree more. It's a great book. And Stan, who's a plant breeder working on sustainable agriculture, makes a really compelling argument for it. Of course, the difference is that a world war is immediate, it's easy to see, and the threat is clearly defined. The threats we're talking about now are going to play out over time. And one of the big problems is that because these warnings have been sounded for decades now, people often, to avoid the question, will say, well, you know, they were talking about this in the 70s and the world's still here. Well, in the 70s, there were some people who made some outrageous predictions, but most of the solid environmental community was saying, listen, this isn't about timetables, it's about inevitabilities, mm-hmm. that we are drawing down the ecological capital of the planet at far beyond replacement levels. And now it's just taken as a given. You know, you can go online and calculate your ecological footprint. You can actually see dramatically how if everybody lived the way we live here in the United States, we would need four planets to make the world work. You know, these things are not, they're not hysterical alarmist claims. They're very solid science. And I have the fortune to talk to a lot of very interesting people, including a lot of ecologists and scientists. And I always ask them one question privately. I say, not apart from what you're saying publicly and in your scientific work, mm-hmm. what do you really think is going to play out here? And to a person, they all say the same thing. Oh, it's far worse than anybody's willing to say in public. It's mm-hmm. far worse than the general public knows. The scientists, I think, are doing a disservice in some sense by being insufficiently vigorous in letting us know what's really happening on this. So there's a lot of denial across the board, and that's right. why this essay I wrote was so important to me, because there's got to be a way we start breaking that denial.
Well, this sort of does get to the heart of your essay, which is that, for instance, you know, I've spoken to James Hansen on my radio show, right?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and he's written all this stuff. And, for instance, his most famous comment in the last year or two is about the tar sands. And he says, well, you know, if this is developed up there right. and it's shipped, it will be, he says, it will be, you know, game over for the planet.
Right.
And we're always reading articles about the tipping point. Well, I think the tipping point has been passed. And this is probably what you're trying to refer yeah. to here. In other words, people really need to know the worst, or there is no way they can meet the crisis. And another comment on something you just said is that, in fact, we are living in a place, even in our own country, where it is an emergency situation, where it is a war against the planet, against our own health, against our own democracy. And the question I'd ask you is, since it is actually an emergency, I mean, look at the droughts, look at the way the government acts in terms of not being democratic anymore. Why is it that since it actually is an emergency, it's not being treated as one by most people?
Well, first of all, just to go back and emphasize, you're absolutely right. When we talk about, as the scientists are, about tipping points and planetary boundaries, this is complex. The Earth is a very complex set of ecosystems, and it doesn't mean that everything's going to, you know, fall into chaos tomorrow. It's a process. And why is it not treated as an emergency? In part because it does emerge slowly over time. Here, the failure of political leadership is quite clear, that none of the things we're talking about today can be discussed within mainstream politics in the United States. That if you and I were to go on the campaign trail, you know, maybe running for the House or the Senate, we would disqualify ourselves immediately by even bringing up these questions. So we have a failed political process that can't deal with this. Again, dealing with emergencies, dealing with terrorism, dealing with world wars, dealing with fascist challenges to Europe, I don't want to pretend those are simple and easy, but they're apprehendable. You can see them immediately.
Mm-hmm.
This is different. And it may be, you know, people have said, and it sounds, again, rather flippant, but I think it's quite serious, It may simply be that the human being with the big brain, you know, this 1,350 cubic centimeter brain that mm-hmm. we have, this 3 pounds of mush in our head that make us able to do so many amazing things, it may be that the human with the big brain is just an evolutionary dead end, that the very skills and cognitive capacities that allow us to dominate the globe the way we do are insufficient to deal with the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not very good at dealing, especially with the unintended consequences. We're also not very good at dealing with the obvious consequences that are painful to deal with. So, you know, we're up against a lot. I think it's, this may sound a little funny,
mm-hmm.
but I think in some ways we should go easy on ourselves. As scientists have pointed out, you know, every life form on the planet basically does one thing. It goes after energy, especially that energy-rich carbon that mm-hmm. fuels life. Well, we're the first species that is going to have to make a conscious decision to limit that quest. And no other species has ever had the capacity or the need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty tall order. Whether we can do it or not, I'm not sure. There's no guarantees in life. But to me, the conversation about this is enriching. That is, you know, people often say to me, oh, God, you're so depressing. You're so cynical.
No. To me, it's exactly the opposite.
I agree completely. I'm neither depressed nor cynical. If I were cynical, I mean, I'm a pretty privileged person. I teach at a university. I've got a nice salary.
Mm-hmm.
If I were cynical, I would just sort of sit back and enjoy whatever material comforts I can, and they're considerable. If I were depressed, I wouldn't be politically active.
And you wouldn't be speaking to me today on the radio, right?
One doesn't have to have a guarantee of success to do useful work in the world. I mean, you know, think about the advice we give young people at every college and high school graduation. You know, seek your dream. Don't be limited by fear of failure. All these things we say to young people on an individual basis, we should be saying to ourselves on a collective basis.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that's where, in fact, I don't want to get kind of almost too mystical here, but that's where, for me, the real joy in life is. I mean, again, I'm lucky. I have a job I like. I get to write. I get to, you know, speak. I get to do a lot of things that I find very pleasurable and rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But the real joy in life for me at this point is the community and political organizing that puts me in touch with like-minded people, many who are struggling with the same kinds of
right.
problems, and doing something useful in the world. And I think, you know, the culture tells people, if you want to be happy, go shopping. If you want to be happy, get a bigger TV.
Well, remember what Bush said. I mean, that's an American statement for all time.
Yeah, and part of what we're really talking about here, beyond the specific policy, how should we, you know, recalculate the economy and taxes and this and that, beyond those policy decisions, what we're really talking about is how do you redefine what it means to live a good life? And that question, what is a good life, is one of the enduring questions of philosophy. It's what people have been struggling with for thousands of years. As long as we've been reflecting and writing down our thoughts, we've been asking that question.
Yeah.
We need a new answer.
Well, you know what? I guess we need a new answer. But, you know, the answer to that question would be different in different parts of the world at different times in the
sure.
world. And when you're talking about the United States of America, which is presumably where we are, you have to say, well, what is it that informs the beginnings of the United States of America? Who came over here first? You know, one of the best books I ever read about this subject is Philip Slater's book, The Pursuit of Loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the kinds of people. This is aside from Africans who were dragged over here in chains,
right.
and also aside from the American Indians who basically, you know, this was their place to begin with. He says all the Europeans that came over here were a certain kind or a personality, and what it had in common were that they weren't interested so much in collective behavior as individual achievement.
Right.
And they came over here. These were the risk takers, for better or for worse. These were, and this is what you get all the time, all about American exceptionalism and individuality and the lone gunman, and you could go on forever with this, but there's a certain ethic in the United States, or a certain, I don't know what the word would be, philosophy that, that you know, it's up to the individual to make their own way, and collectivism of any sort is regarded with distaste or horror by the general American political establishment. Also, I would add to that the media, which is essentially a tool of the same group of people.
Yeah, I think that that particular character of the people who conquered the United States, the Europeans,
yeah, conquered is a good word.
Is at the heart of this. You know, I think everybody recognizes, or everybody should recognize, that you know, we are individuals and our lives make no sense outside of a collective. And so the United States, to borrow from a philosopher I appreciate, the United States is based on the notion of individualism, this almost pathological concern for the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And the question, I think, is can be phrased this way. Can we have space for individuality without this harsh individualism? When we let loose that sort of greed and concern only for self-interest, which is in some odd way the moral basis for capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is actually a moral argument for capitalism. It says if you let people act in greedy and self-interested ways, then the common good will actually be served because people will do all these things. Well, the fact that it hasn't worked out very well maybe suggests we should rethink that, and that there has to be this balance. We also know that societies that value nothing but the collective in the modern world tend to be authoritarian. So we're looking in the moment in history we have to survive. We're looking for this balance between a recognition and fostering of the differences between us, and also recognizing we're all pretty much the same. You know, when I'm joking with incoming students at the University of Texas, I often say, you're all special, just like a snowflake, and you're all essentially indistinguishable. And that's true of all human beings.
Let's
Both
think
things
of it.
Are
so,
true. We
like,
are
yeah,
all
like,
individual, and we all are essentially the same animal.
I read the same thing when I read Buddhist texts sometimes.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Which is you are the center of the world, and, you know, collectively, without a collective behavior, yeah, and, at the same time you're the center of the world, you're also connected to everything else in the world.
So,
but how do you instill the understanding and awareness and action on that balance in a political structure?
Well, I think it's very hard to simply articulate it. I think it's one of these things where actually doing it, modeling it, creating organizations, institutions, networks of people that make that possible is really important. That's why more and more, I think, for those of us doing left, progressive, radical organizing, whatever you want to call it, there's an even deeper awareness than ever that the institutions, the organizations, the networks we form have to reflect this kind of ethic that you're talking about. You know, it's very easy when one feels the compelling need to work for justice, to work for ecological sustainability. It's easy to think, well, we got to get the job done by any means necessary. But when getting the job done means mimicking the worst of the dominant culture, we not only undermine our long-term chances of success, but we don't then model an alternative. And, you know, this has been discussed for a long time in political science. They call it the notion of prefigurative politics, that in the groups that you start that imagine an alternative, you have to act out that alternative as well. And it's hard. You know, I find it, you know, all the time, this struggle between wanting to get the job done and be efficient, but also wanting to create an environment where people feel supported, where people's talents are not only kind of exploited, but fostered. All of this stuff, you know, these may sound like, you know, kind of almost soft questions. You know, it's not the hard business of politics to worry about these things. But increasingly, I think if we don't attend to these questions, we have no hope whatsoever. In a way, we're in a very, to go back to something you said earlier, we're in a very strange point that one book called The Long Emergency, right? We're in a crisis. This is an emergency. There's no time to fool around. We should have started on these projects 20 years ago, 30 years ago. If we want to be sustainable, we need an energy policy that should have been instituted, you know, 50 years ago. That's all true. There's an urgency to it. But it is a long emergency. We're not going anywhere. We're stuck with this. And we've got to work out solutions, or at least attempts at solutions.
Makes me think of Raymond Chandler, The Long Goodbye, which is not what he was absolutely referring to, but still it is. If we don't start facing this and feeling it, then it is the long goodbye. We're in the middle of it, right? Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, as someone who's had a lot of luck in his life, you know, I'm a I'm a professor. I have a job that pays me fairly well, and I get to do work I like. I happen to be white male. I'm a U.S. citizen. You know, there's a lot of privilege in my life. You know, a friend of mine always says, Jensen, if you'd been born good-looking, you would have had it all.
Well, so some of this you got for free, but some of it you worked for.
Well, but the point is that once one recognizes that, the question is, what do you owe the larger world? What's your obligation? Not only an obligation to others, but an obligation to yourself. You know, I think what we're circling around, in a sense, is a recognition that what is called success in the United States today is a very empty kind of way to live. You know, take somebody, I don't know, just if you want to use a kind of cartoonish character, somebody like Donald Trump. Does anybody ever really want to be Donald Trump? Not me. You can give me all of Donald Trump's money, and if I had to be like Donald Trump to get it, I'm sorry.
Now, that's something we could all understand, but I'm recalling, and I'm paraphrasing here, something that Steinbeck said way back in the 30s when he was, if you read Grapes of Wrath, it's probably the most, I don't know what, socialist, communist novel ever written in this. It's an incredible novel. And he once said, what was the problem here? Why don't people get it? You know, why are they all trying to be rich? He said the problem in this country was that every American believes down deep in his soul that one day he will be rich.
But
I'm just answering your question. I mean, look at Mayor Bloomberg. Yeah. Everybody in this city who has any brains or heart detests this man. He has $24 billion, and he's closing senior centers. Okay, so nobody wants to be Bloomberg. Nobody wants to be Donald Trump, God forbid. But people do want to win money. They all play the lottery. They all who do we admire more than some guy who went to his garage, dropped out of Harvard, developed something, and has $10 billion? In other words, there's this little bug in the center of the American psyche. You know what I mean? So how do you address that?
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think you can tell a lot about a society by who it counts as heroes. And the heroes of the moment, you know, apart from movie actors and baseball stars and things, really are business people, people who've made a lot of money. And that's a very strange thing. It's a very strange thing, especially in a country that the dominant religious tradition is Christianity. And this is one of the things I've been trying to highlight as often as possible.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the essay.
Yeah, if one takes seriously the core of the Christian faith, and I happen to be one of those people who goes to a very radical Christian church where we don't have a lot of supernatural beliefs about God and Jesus. But
this is it. This is in Austin?
Yeah, in Austin, Texas.
Because I have friends who live in Katy, Texas, so Texas is a funny place.
It is indeed. There's a lot of a big range of what that word Christian means in this state and in this country and, in fact, in the world. And that's part of what interests me in Christianity. I happen to have grown up in a Protestant home and was schooled in the sort of traditional way that America schools its Christians, but what I finally woke up to late in life was that the tradition that really speaks to me in Christianity, the tradition from the first couple of centuries of the faith, is a tradition that is, I think, directly opposed to the values in empire, the values in capitalism. The early Christians, in fact, the whole New Testament is saturated with this talk, is about communal living, about solidarity, about finding one's joy in the collective expression of faith to a larger power. All right, well, that is all in direct opposition to contemporary capitalism. The power of the United States, the imperial power, you know, of the day, is in direct opposition to that faith. And so if I keep challenging, especially the conservative students who come through my office, who are very pro-capitalist, pro-American, and deeply religious, deeply Christian often.
And you try to point them, I have to point out to them, how does this go together?
I don't beat them up about why they should change their politics. I simply say, how do you square the obvious, you know, tone of the New Testament with these political and economic systems?
Well, I'm interested. What's the response to that question?
Well, often I think I find young people more interesting than older folks, in part because they're more open. And, you know, I'm thinking of one particular student, her first year at UT, who did come out of one of those homes that was traditionally right-wing on questions of country and economy, and also a very devout Christian. And I put that challenge to her, and she looked at me funny and said, kind of, I'll get back to you on this one. And that's, of course, what you want. You want people to go off and ponder what that means. Now, I don't have an answer to it. I'm constantly sort of searching myself for what kind of political and economic system is consistent, not just with Christianity, but with the fundamental ethical principles that inform most of our lives.
But you know, since you bring the subject up, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Since you bring, by the way, if you just tuned in, I'm having so much fun talking to you, I forget to re-identify you. listening to Rob, my guest is Robert Jensen. That's J-E-N-S-E-N. He's a journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. Latest book is All My Bones Shake, Radical Politics and the Prophetic Voice, Soft Skull Press. And what was the other book you mentioned?
The latest one after that is called Arguing for Our Lives. Okay. It's really a primer on critical thinking about all of these subjects, and it's from City Lights Press.
City Lights. Wow, well, that's a great place to be connected to, considering their history.
I mean, great bookstore still, by the way, if you're ever in San Francisco. It's one of those truly wonderful bookstore experiences to just amble through City Lights.
Yeah, we had our version here in New York City was the Gotham bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would see the poets browsing. So is there a website where people can go to read things that you've written or to contact
you? Yeah, a lot of essays and things are online for free. The easiest way is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and my university website will come up. And I do, write a lot of shorter pieces that I hope engage people on these topics, and all of that's up and online for free.
And this is this thing we're talking about, the essay we're talking about right now, is in Yes Magazine. And I recommend this to everybody who's listening. I mean, you hear me come in here week after week after week. Now I've been doing it for decades. And ringing the alarm bell, watch out, it's not good. You have to pay attention. And it's always good to talk to somebody who's got their eyes wide open, who's looking at things and who also feels a sense of joy in the possibilities that still exist, So one last thing I wanted to ask you about this essay, which is that you put in here some challenges. This is not just an essay about ways abstractly to look at the world, but you're talking, you put some challenges in here to liberals where people consider themselves leftists, right?
Yeah, I think... the biggest challenge, of course, is to not give in to the sense of despair. And I fully understand why that is often a temptation. I think that there are places we can do work in the more traditional political realm, candidates running for election, especially at the local level. But what we really have to be doing is looking to push the more radical analyses and then try to find ways to actually put that into practice. We've been lucky in Austin, a group of us have started a community center. We have both an immigrant worker justice center that fights for the most vulnerable workers in the society. We have a worker cooperative incubator where we're helping people who want to start worker-owned, worker-run businesses. Mm-hmm. We have a great community garden and a younger group of people who are making that work in our backyard. None of those projects in and of themselves are the revolution. But my own view is that there is no revolution coming anytime soon. There are a lot of small acts that are informed by a revolutionary spirit that may create conditions for real change coming up. And in the meantime, we're building those connections, we're building those networks. Interestingly, in Austin, across the divides of age and race and ethnicity, which are, of course, these huge gaps in our culture. Mm-hmm. So older and younger folks working together, white and non-white working together in a world that's often segregated along those lines. So I'm incredibly upbeat. The last 5 years in Austin have been a kind of second wind, largely, as I said, because I've reconnected with younger people, and that's the way that we old folks are going to stay fresh.
Oh, it always works that way. It's inevitable. I mean, I'm 68 now, and the more time I spend with young people, even very young people, the more I still believe in the possibilities of the world. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you said in your essay here, is that that one of the things, people come from the 60s, from my generation. We had an anti-war movement. There were cooperative ventures, mm-hmm. some of which were fueled by a little too much whatever, but, and fell apart. But also, there was a civil rights movement. We had this opportunity to try to change systems, you know, cultural and political systems, which actually, in some cases, were just temporary, but actually seemed in the long run to work. And then we get to a certain age, over our 60s now, or late 50s, like 60s, and there's a lot of depression, despair among people my age who saw a lot of their efforts succeed once, and now nothing good is coming of any protest that they're doing, right? And so they're kind of disenchanted. And I just wanted to chime in with you about this idea of, you're talking before about the long emergency. I think there's something called the long revolution, to put it in your terms, where there are cooperative groups. In other words, things have to start from the bottom up. You can't attack the larger established machine in any way at all. You'll bounce right off it as if they don't even know you exist.
Yeah, you know. Let's take a concrete example. The 2003 February 15th protest to try and stop the war in Iraq.
Right.
Okay, that failed. And a lot of people walked away from that very depressed. And I understand that. I put a lot of energy into that organizing. All it did was tell me that some of the traditional forms of political intervention, like large street protests, simply didn't have the same effect they did maybe 30 years ago. Okay, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do.
There must be a reason for that, right? What is the reason that that doesn't work?
Well, I think the most obvious reason is that the combination of the media's lack of interest and the lack of a vibrant, ongoing movement. Remember, you know, people in power don't look at one day and say, oh, big protest, we better get worried.
Right.
In the Vietnam War era, and I'm too young to have been part of that organizing, I was 10 years old in 1968, mm-hmm. So I'm thinking historically now, the power of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War movement, wasn't just one event, one day, one protest. It was that people in power saw those as serious challenges to the structures of authority. Now, building movements through street protests and other things in that context is a very different thing than a largely middle-class anti-war movement getting together on one day and saying, we don't like your policy.
Mm.
The people in Washington, I'm sure George W. Bush and the gang on that day looked and said, interesting protest, but it's not going to amount to anything. And I think they were right. They knew that the people who were out that day were not going to be out the next day threatening the structures of power. Okay, well, that's where we were as a movement at that point. I think the media is even more skilled at kind of ignoring the underlying challenge presented by groups like this. I think that day of action on February 15th, which was an amazing accomplishment, 10 to 15 million people worldwide on the largest day of coordinated political activity in the history of the world, that's not nothing. But it wasn't going to be successful in the way that we hoped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. Let's drop back. Let's get a new strategy, and let's keep working. I, in a perhaps kind of odd way, was energized by that day, not to keep going but on that track, but to start recommitting to a different kind of organizing. And that's the kind of thinking we need, the kind of conversations we need to have.
But what is your opinion, finally, of the existing, for instance, a lot of people write into me. I was backing the Green Party, just as an example, in the last election. You know, Jill Stein, she was on the show, talking about how it's a waste of time to worry about national politics because they're all the same people. And if you look at a place like MapLite, you see that basically the contributions, make them what they are. A lot of people got very angry at me and said, you know, there's only two choices. You have to vote. Remember the great phrase, the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a way of looking at things from now on? Do we worry about reforming the Democratic Party, or what is your response to that?
Well, my own view is that the Democratic Party is a lost cause. And I also voted for Barack Obama in both elections. In other words, mm-hmm. I kind of am agnostic on this question, or not agnostic, very situational. There are times and places where I think where one votes in a presidential election matters. I think the fact that Barack Obama was elected in symbolic terms mattered. It didn't have a great effect on policy, but it did have some effect as well. So I don't think there's anything inconsistent with saying I have no faith in the Democratic Party and will put no time or energy into it, and also voting for Democratic candidates at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The real work of politics at this point, I think, is at the local level, the grassroots level, not disconnected from any national organizing, but the flow up from the grassroots. The worker cooperative movement, I think, is really a great example of this. As you pointed out, the idea of cooperatives, whether they were food co-ops or housing co-ops or whatever, goes way, way back, not only to the 60s, but before that. But this worker cooperative movement, the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives organizing here and part of an international movement, is a really good model for how people can say, listen, whatever's going on in Washington, we're going to start to create alternatives here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a perfectly fine approach. If I were smart enough to design the grand strategy to change the world, I wouldn't hesitate to tell you. But luckily, I'm smart enough to know I'm not smart enough for that. But I do know what works in a moment. I can see what brings people together. I can reflect on where I can be of most value. I think we sometimes expect too much of ourselves in this sense, too. We don't really have all the answers. I'm not even sure we have any answers at the moment. But I can tell the difference between political activity that builds a sense of community and political activity that doesn't. Working for the Democratic Party doesn't build community where I live. Working with the worker cooperative movement does. So in that sense, it's an easy choice.
That's a very clear way to put it. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And, all over the country, I'm fortunate. I get to travel a lot. And almost everywhere I go, there are people, doing this kind of work. And if you're living somewhere where people aren't doing it, that's just an incentive to create a group. There's lots of good movements to plug into. Mm-hmm. We just have to decide we want to do it.
But we all get comfortable too, right? I mean, for instance, I was looking around. I was thinking about interviewing you today on the radio, and I'm sitting in my living room. It's 11 o'clock at night, and, I turn the lights out. It's easy to think sometimes without everything. And I look around, and I see something that I didn't see when I was – and then I go way back, so – there must have been 28 lights blinking in the living room. Looked like little snake eyes all over. And you know what I'm talking about, right?
Sure, sure.
I mean, it used to be when I was 18 or even 25, if I turned the lights out in my living room, the lights were out.
Yep.
But now the preamp for this is on. The humidifier light, which is blue, is on. This one is green. That one's yellow. When you wrote this essay, you typed it on a computer, right?
Absolutely.
And sometimes maybe, let's say you're a sports fan, you might write, look at a TV or a computer screen and watch a baseball team or whatever it is, a basketball team. In other words, there are things that you do and that I do, and hopefully we try to do the things that are positive and try to help people. But we depend on all this energy that everybody is addicted to, right?
Right, and that's why it's so clear that although I think individual choices matter, and I don't deny the importance of making ecologically sensible choices in how we transport ourselves or what we do to entertain ourselves, those decisions, everyone understands, alone are not enough because we're talking about a collective mm-hmm. process. We're talking about a system. So I think both things matter. I don't know if it's just the way I was raised or whatever, but I tend toward frugality. I don't buy things I don't need. I don't have a lot of electronic devices. But as you point out, I work in a modern university. If I didn't have a computer, I couldn't do my job. I take advantage of a lot of the high-energy technology that's available.
In other words,
but
you can't turn your back.
I also recognize that when we come to make collective decisions about energy and transportation in these things, we all are going to have to accept a world with less of everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's not a threat. It's hard to be an outlier. It's hard to be the oddball who doesn't do what everybody else is doing. But when collectively we make a decision that we're not going to all get on jet airplanes all the time and we're all not going to buy flat-screen TVs all the time, then all of a sudden, our expectations are usually keyed to the groups we're part of.
Right.
And all of that's possible. There's no reason we can't start to change the world in that through that process.
And it's also useful, I think, for people who are Christians and non-Christians alike to think of the original Christian groups, which were small groups of people that did not discriminate in terms of sex, whoever was running, or gender, whoever was running the group ran the group and shared whatever bread they had, and take a good look at that, because that's your basis for what we should do now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The early Christian experience, whether one believes, doesn't believe, has faith, doesn't, I don't care, is an interesting you know, sort of moment in history. Because as you point out, it was premised on two things that the contemporary Christian church tends to ignore. One is that collective notion of sharing all in common. If you read the book of Acts, it's right there spelled out. And the other is in I think it's in Galatians, one of Paul's letters, he said, in Christ there is neither Greek nor Jew, master nor slave, male or female. It was this sense that if we come together, for me it doesn't have to be around Christ, but if we come together with a sense of our shared human identity, then all those other divisions become less important. But it doesn't happen naturally. You have to work at it. Right. And much of the modern world is constructed to keep us from working at that. So we're really dealing with a lot of impediments,
but we're
also dealing with a world that gives us models, often models from, you know, centuries ago.
Yeah, well, listen, we're right up at the end, and I appreciate your sticking around for so long, and a wonderful essay. It was in Yes Magazine, and check it out, by Robert Jensen. It will inspire you in these times of difficulty. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for a great conversation. Appreciate it.
Okay. We're about at the end of the show here. This is Mike Fader. It's Occupied Territory America. The podcast of the show will be available sometimes later today or tomorrow. Share it with everybody you know. Robert Jensen, Yes Magazine. That's it for today.
As I went walking